All right. The first case for argument this morning is the United States v. Bailey. Ms. Dura? That's Bailey et al., I should say.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Maribeth Dura, and I represent the appellant, Shane Williams. On appeal, we assert that the evidence was not sufficient to sustain the conviction for conspiracy and two counts of distribution of crack cocaine. The evidence at trial for the government was that of several individuals, specifically Donald and Demetrius Coleman, Martez Harris, John T.Y. Young, Stephen Wright, Jason and Richard Parker, Michael Williams, and they provided testimony regarding obtaining and selling drugs to Shane Williams to support the conspiracy charge. These individuals were multi-convicted felons. Each testified that they had were looking for a benefit for a cut in their time, and we would assert that they were not credible witnesses. Regarding the distribution counts, the government relied on the testimony of Victon Bethel, who was the person that the appellant delivered to or was involved in with others, delivered to Mr. Bethel. Mr. Bethel also was a multi-convicted felon, a user of drugs, an addict. But one thing was different about Mr. Bethel than the garden variety cases that would govern this case, and that is he had admitted on the August 29th, 2002 delivery that he had been smoking marijuana earlier that morning. And also the evidence showed that he also, while he was working for the government, was selling drugs as well, and actually had been convicted of a felony for drugs while he was working for the government.
But Ms. Dura, all of this was before the jury, right? I mean, they wished to discount the credibility of these witnesses, had the knowledge that they would have needed to do that. I mean, as you point out in your own brief, we normally don't reverse on lack of credibility unless the testimony is incredible as a matter of law. You know, you say you were in one place, and 15 minutes later you say you were in a place 150 miles away. Well, you know, short of, you know, Star Trek or something, you can't do that. So, but we don't have anything like that here.
The only difference that I saw in the cases that are cited in this case was that Mr. Bethel was using drugs on the day of the delivery, which
is a factor for sure the jury could have taken into account. And if they hadn't learned about that, that would be something that would be a serious problem, I think. But if they knew that there might have been some impairment of his ability to observe, there's nothing in this evidence that suggests it was a total impairment, is there?
No, there isn't. But I'm submitting just the fact that he used on the day of the delivery, that should be enough to reverse this conviction. And in light of the other evidence, there was really no corroborating evidence. There were no statements from the defendant.
Except didn't all these, I mean, you mentioned quite a few names, didn't all these people more or less cross-corroborate one another?
There were two, possibly, that said that they had seen him with one of the other individuals, but I would submit to the court that those, I mean, the testimony as a whole was not credible at all, and so that's the basis for my argument, and based on the fact that all these witnesses were miserably incredible, and the fact that Bethel was using on that day and was also handsomely paid and convicted of a drug charge while working for the government, I would ask the court to consider reversing.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Dura. Mr. Daniels?
Thank you, Justices. I have three issues. I want to talk about the evidentiary issues first because it deals with the tenet of this trial. The first is dealing with the trespassing issue. And I think the court was totally incorrect in regard to presenting testimony that my client was arrested. I said 60 days, but it was closer to 90 days prior to the August 29th drug deal that occurred. My concern with this evidentiary issue is that it was so overduly prejudicial to my client that the tenet of this trial was unfair. Specifically, if the court reviews what occurred here, is the state, U.S. attorney did not present the fact that he was on a trespassing list, which may very well be acceptable to present as testimony. They present testimony that he's arrested in the homes where this drug deal occurred.
But the court does restrict this. I'm looking at the
yes.
transcript that you attached, and the court says he allows it because this was enough to show he wasn't welcome at Taft. That's why he has to be working with somebody else. And the court keeps out the
yes.
the master key
yes.
business.
And brings in the most damaging portion that he was arrested. And what's interesting is the factual basis that the court argues to be allowed is contrived by the court. The U.S. attorney never ever comes in and says, yes, this is the reason why we're presenting this testimony. The U.S. attorney never stated that. The court did. The court says, oh, yeah, you can present this because that shows that maybe he wasn't going to go in into the Taft homes at the time of the August 29th deal. That's contrived.
But Mr. Murphy says... the relevance is that he's arrested for trespass, which would show Mr. Bailey's reluctance to be out
right.
and about at the property of the Taft Homes within just a couple of months. Then the court he rephrases,
right.
but it seems to me Mr. Murphy's already said that.
But the point is that the August 29th deal occurs at the Taft Homes. So, I mean, they're saying that it's definitely a contrived factual reason, and it's so prejudicial. All they had to do was say, okay, he wasn't supposed to be in the Taft Homes. Let's do a stipulation that he's on the trespass list. That's not what they presented here. If it was just an initial where they said he's on a trespass list and he's not allowed in the Taft Homes, then I don't have error. But that's not what I have here. What I have here is an arrest. And the arrest goes so prejudicial because it shows he's in a home he's not supposed to be in. It goes to bad character. It goes to the fact, oh, yeah, this guy has to be guilty because he was doing this 90 days before. And the same thing with my second evidentiary issue that deals with presence, where the court says, well, you're having a bad moment here. This is probably not good for you. Well, I don't think that's an issue. I think the issue is it shouldn't have been allowed in. This was the guy's half-brother or brother. He hung around him, and then presenting all this testimony, and it's numerous testimony as him being present during the drug deals. And in the U.S. attorney's brief, he says, well, that's not harmful, that's neutral. I disagree. The court, the jury could say, oh, yeah, well, he was around during these drug deals, therefore he must be guilty. And that's how the tenor of this trial happened. The evidence wasn't overwhelming. I'm not saying it wasn't sufficient, but it wasn't overwhelming in regard to my client. And these evidentiary issues are clearly not only not relevant material, they clearly should not have been brought up. They should have been not presented to the jury. And who's for us to say that the jury, when they went back, said, yeah, he was in the Taft Homes 90 days milling about. He was around during the time that the deals were occurring. Guilt by association, and he's guilty. We can't say that. And I think that these issues are important issues for these, this court to consider. The third issue deals with the IRS income tax that was not, I was not allowed, and I believe was a Brady issue. The government says in their brief again that, well, he admitted on direct examination or during, cross-examination by one of the co-defendants that he didn't declare his taxes, so I can't complain. And I disagree again. I think there's a big difference between having a statement saying, yeah, I didn't declare it with me showing the tax form, specifically showing his execution on the tax form, showing that he committed a federal crime. I cannot prove up a federal crime without having the actual tax form. There is no way that I can argue to the jury, and we've been objected to, that this man committed a federal crime without having the sufficient indication that he did not, that he signed the form. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Daniels. Mr. Carlin?
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jeremy Carlin. I represent Orlando Alexander, the appellant in this case. Judge, I disagree with my fellow counsel, as I did at trial, is that this was a case that proved that Tim Bailey and Shane Williams were drug dealers and involved in a conspiracy. We argued at trial, as we argue here today, that the evidence was insufficient to establish that my client, Orlando Alexander, had entered into the conspiracy. We also concede at this point that the conviction as it relates to the August 13th drug deal, August 13th, 2002, reluctantly was sufficient, and we're not appealing on this at this point. Judge, imagine, if you would, a circumstance in which I have a friend who has a Honda dealership. I drive a Honda because I got a good deal from the Honda dealer. Another friend says, well, Jeremy, you know, you have a really nice car. Where'd you get it? I said, well, I got it from Bob, the car dealer. You know, you want his number? Well, sure, I'll give you the number. It's that type of circumstance, Judge, that I think Orlando Alexander finds in this case. Orlando Alexander, his assistants, while I guess technically could be aiding and abetting, and he'd be responsible perhaps as a principal on the initial drug deals, his assistance was of such an insignificant nature, such that the trier of fact could not infer that he had entered into an agreement with the drug dealer Shane Williams or the drug dealer Tim Bailey to sell drugs. In this case, Judge, I think despite the government's characterization of this, both in appeal and trial, my client gave the confidential source, Victim Bethel, and mind you, Victim Bethel is tangentially related to my client. He is the father of my client's sister's child. I don't know exactly how that works, but that's a relation. Victim Bethel asked my client about whether or not he could get drugs from somebody. My client gives him the phone number. My client is also present. He also does know that a drug deal is going down, but presence, knowledge, association, these are things that this court has ruled time and time again are insufficient alone to prove a conspiracy.
But the key word there is alone, and I think the government suggests that once you take all of this evidence together, you can see. I mean, they concede Alexander isn't as significant a member as the other people, but you can see that he's providing a kind of facilitator role, if you will. He's getting people together. He's arranging for people to show up. He's giving pager numbers out. He's helping in that way. And maybe a jury could have seen it the other way, but why wasn't the jury entitled to take all of these pieces of evidence together and say that he was a member of the conspiracy?
I would agree with you, Your Honor, that these are certainly factors that the jury could consider. But under these circumstances, I believe that the level of assistance in this particular case didn't go to such a point that it showed that there was actually an agreement between Shane Williams, Tim Bailey, and Orlando Alexander. Certainly, Judge, of course, there are never written documents, right? there are never contracts that put this down, and we all have to go by circumstantial evidence. And that's the nature of the beast, of course. But the fact, the nature of the beast also is that in the Taft homes, you know, people know what people are doing, I suspect. And, you know, Orlando Alexander, admittedly being a user of drugs, there's testimony in this trial in which he purchased for personal use, he's going to know who the drug dealers are. And so when his associate, victim Bethel, says, I'd like to know, you know, hey, where do you get some drugs? He's going to be able to say, you know, my friend's a drug dealer, or not, my associate's a drug dealer. But that, even with knowledge and association and phone calls back and forth, he's not, there isn't then an agreement. You know, I call my wife 3 times a day. I call her many times over throughout the year. I think she's associated with me, much to her consternation, I suspect. But she knows I practice law and she lives with me. Has she entered into a conspiracy with me to practice law such that her efforts are then the unauthorized practice of law? No. And maybe that's a ridiculous situation, but that's the same thing that Orlando Alexander has here. In this particular case, Orlando Alexander, to some extent, facilitated two people coming together, a desirous buyer and a willing seller. There has to be a certain threshold, though, that this circumstantial evidence coming in, there has to be a certain threshold in which the assistance has to reach. Like, for example...
But he knew it was a drug deal. He brings the people together. They call him back. They say, we need more. I mean, at the end of the day, he really is one of the, let's say, people who make sure that the transaction is successfully completed.
Well, Judge, I'd respectfully disagree with that characterization because there's no evidence in this case, in fact, that he had any stake in the outcome, that there was any type of history of him actually dealing with these individuals. Going back to the Honda example for a second, with my friend who has the Honda dealership, if I'm out there consistently saying to my friends and associates, hey, I love my Honda Accord, you should buy it, and you should buy it from this guy, and then there's this continual history of this continuing, I think then once the Honda dealer knows that I'm doing this, that there can be an inference that there is essentially an agreement. But under this case here, Judge, we only have evidence of essentially two drug deals that my client, to the limited extent he was involved, was actually involved. This was a case about this is a case about Bailey and Williams. My client just happened to be there as the spare tire, it seems, and I think under these circumstances there was insufficient evidence to prove that there was a conspiracy. This matter should be remanded for resentencing on one charge alone. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlin. Mr. Cox.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Richard Cox on behalf of the United States. I think I'd like to begin by addressing the sufficiency of the evidence arguments, first with regard to the defendant, Shane Williams. Obviously, the Court, by its, especially Judge Wood, by your comments, the issue in the case is credibility and solely credibility. The charge by Ms. Dura is that no rational trier of fact could have found her client guilty because the witnesses that the government put forth were so terrible. Well, I'm not going to defend the witnesses. They were clearly all longtime drug users, felons, nasty people, people none of us would want to associate with. But that's the nature of trials oftentimes, particularly in the drug arena in federal court. And all counsel ably demonstrated to the jury all of these problems that these witnesses had, their inconsistent statements, their prior convictions, their drug usage, their drug sales, their desires to curry favor with the government, because every one of them, I think, was facing either reductions of sentence or hope for reductions of sentence or awaiting a lessening of sentences for which they hadn't been sentenced yet. In any event, they all pointed these out. They were cross-examined vigorously on all of these factors, and they were argued vigorously to the jury in closing arguments. We're never going to know which of these witnesses maybe the jurors decided to believe. I can't say they believed them all. I certainly may not have believed all of them on everything they said, but they certainly believed enough of what these witnesses said to support the conviction. And there's just simply nothing with regard to credibility that would allow this court to overturn the jury's judgment in that regard with regard to Mr. Williams. Turning my attention to Mr. Alexander, as we conceded in our brief, and as Judge Wood also mentioned, it was certainly not the government's theory, and certainly the evidence wouldn't bear out that he was one of the prime movers in this conspiracy. But all conspirators don't have to be equal participants. They don't all have to have the same shared stake in a conspiracy. And clearly in this case, the question was, did a conspiracy exist? Mr. Carlin admitted that the conspiracy existed. So the question then only is, did Mr. Alexander choose to participate in it?
Was there any evidence that Mr. Alexander ever got any cut of the payments or proceeds?
There was no evidence that he got any share of the proceeds, Your Honor, other than, I suppose, just an inference in a conspiracy case that people don't do these out of they do it for some self-interest.
Would that matter? I mean, if it turned out he was just, for some reason, doing all of these things as a favor to the other people in the conspiracy?
I don't think it would matter, Your Honor, because there's no requirement to be a member of a conspiracy that you actually get something in return for it. The question is, did you know about it? Was there a conspiracy? Did you know about it? And did you choose to participate in it? And clearly, Mr. Alexander's actions in this case showed that he chose to participate in it, as most demonstrated in the transactions with Mr. Bethel. Mr. Bethel, who says he bought from Mr. Alexander several times at the Taft Homes in 2002 before he became a police informant, tells the police about Mr. Bethel. He calls up Mr. Alexander. He asks if he can purchase an ounce. Mr. Alexander says, sure, and he brings Shane Williams, the acknowledged leader of this conspiracy, with him to Mr. Bethel's apartment in the Taft Homes and participates in the delivery of 1 ounce of crack cocaine. He then supplies Mr. Bethel with Mr. Williams, again, the acknowledged leader of this conspiracy, his pager number, so that not only can he get a hold of Mr. Alexander if he needs crack cocaine, but he can also get a hold of Mr. Williams. Then, of course, there's another deal arranged through the use of the pager. Mr. Alexander is not charged in connection with that, not found guilty in connection with that, obviously. And then finally, the third one, where, for want of a better word, I think in our brief we called him the agent on site. I mean, he runs around the perimeter of the Taft Homes while Mr. Bailey is going back and forth trying to put this deal together, and assures Mr. Bethel the transaction is going to happen, continually calls Mr. Williams and Mr. Bailey to find out what's going on, and it even at one point gives Mr. Bethel his cell phone so that he can talk to Mr. Bailey and find out, when are you coming back to deliver the drugs I ordered? So I think all of those things show that whether he was actually going to get a cut of that, he certainly had some stake in it, and I think you could infer that there was some benefit to him, and that would be sufficient for the jury to have concluded that he was also a member of the conspiracy. With regard to the evidentiary issues that Mr. Daniels raised on behalf of Mr. Bailey, first with regard to the tax matter, I guess that's not the evidentiary matter, but there was no Brady violation. There was no question the government was not in possession of Mr. Bethel's tax returns. It would have required an order to get that document. Those are confidential matters. They do require a district court judge's order. Mr. Daniels doesn't argue otherwise. But most importantly, in this case, the jury knew he was a tax cheat, to use Mr. Daniels' words. And besides being a tax cheat, they knew that Mr. Bethel was a very bad person who had a lot to gain by his testimony in this case, that he was a multi-convicted felon, that he committed crimes while he was working with the police. He just was not a very likable, he may have been a despicable fellow, but the jury chose to believe him based on the corroborating evidence as well.
Would you have objected if Mr. Daniels had said, here's this man, he admits that he failed to report this income on his income tax returns, that means he's committed a federal crime? Would you have made any objection to that statement?
If Mr. Daniels would have argued
that? If Mr. Daniels had just taken the next step, as you point out, the witness testifies, I didn't report this income on my federal tax forms. And your argument is that means that the forms themselves were completely unnecessary because there's the fact. But would you have objected if Mr. Daniels had said he's admitted he didn't report the income on the forms, that's a federal crime?
I would not, if I was trying the case, I would not have objected. In my view, Mr. Bethel was already portrayed as such a despicable human being, or at least who had so many motivations to testify untruthfully, that quite frankly, to me, would have been almost insignificant. I would not have objected to that had Mr. Daniels made that statement at trial. Mm-hmm. With regard to the presence at the drug deals, one of the common factors particularly in conspiracy cases, as long as I've been a federal prosecutor, is to show at least an association between the individuals. And oftentimes we put in, for instance, nothing more than telephone records that show that I was communicating with you, Judge Wood, by telephone. We don't know what was said, but at least it does tend to establish that we had some association. That's all this did. It showed that Mr. Bailey, whether he was allowed inside the house when the drug transactions occurred, accompanied, drove, maybe acted as a chauffeur for his brother, Mr. Williams, on all of these occasions when significant amounts of drugs were transacted. Obviously, then he's driving a car with somebody who is carrying drugs. He did this repeatedly. Obviously, Mr. Daniels, as he argued at trial, could argue that, he was kept outside. So that shows he's outside of the conspiracy. So I don't see what prejudicial impact this testimony had. If anything, it was susceptible of two inferences, and the government chose to take an inference that said he knew what he was doing. Again, it showed his association with Mr. Williams and his participation in the conspiracy. And Mr. Daniels can argue that it showed that he was excluded from the conspiracy. So there just simply was no prejudicial impact to this testimony. Finally, with regard to the trespassing evidence, I went back this morning and I reread the transcript, and I believe that Judge McDade specifically asked Mr. Daniels at the sidebar specifically what other crimes or other problems he was attributing to this testimony, and Mr. Daniels said burglary in the possession of the master keys. And the judge kept that, any testimony concerning possession of master keys or burglaries, out, instructed the prosecutor not to do that to the extent that it hadn't already been discussed in the testimony prior to the requested sidebar. But I think it's clear from Judge McDade's remarks that he viewed this as virtually unimportant, or at least unimportant is not the right word, certainly not arising to the level that Mr. Daniels described it as overtly and severely prejudicial. This evidence clearly explained why Mr. Bailey could not even get out of his car to do a drug deal. He wasn't allowed on the Taft Homes. He was subject to arrest on site by a police officer. It explained then why Mr. Alexander needed to act as the on-site agent for Mr. Williams and Mr. Bailey, at least with regard to their drug distribution activities in the Taft Homes. I think, Your Honors, that if you have no further questions, then I would yield back the balance of my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Ms. Dura, you had reserved some time for rebuttal.
I would respectfully waive that.
All right. Well, first of all, our thanks to all counsel. And Ms. Dura, Mr. Daniels, and Mr. Carlin, you were all appointed in this case. And you have the additional thanks of the court for your able representation of the petitioners.